Today's broadcast originally aired on September 20th, 2023.
Finally, I want to remind everyone yet again that this is what good faith oversight looks like, not the Republican playbook of running interference for a twice impeached, four times indicted white supremacist demagogue who would rather overthrow our democracy than admit he lost an election.
Oh, man. Someone get that congresswoman a job with the media, please. Pretty please. We need her.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
She's pretty good in Congress, too.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
But the media really
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am... From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, we got some good news out of Pennsylvania, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, good news there too, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, in Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950. KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us, Desi Doyen. That was Cori Bush,
yes.
Was it, at the top there?
Yes, it was.
That was the hearing in the so-called, well, in the Judiciary Committee in the U.S. House, that hearing with Merrick Garland, Attorney General Merrick Garland, on Wednesday, in which they harangued and harassed him for all sorts of imaginary things that, guess what, we will not be covering on today's broadcast.
Correct, and thank you.
You're welcome. I see no reason to give more oxygen to all of that nonsense. Fox News will take care of it. They're fair and balanced, after all. Coming up shortly, however, the great Dan Frumkin, formerly of Washington Post, then HuffPo, then The Intercept, now of Press Watch, focusing on mainstream media and its many dangerous failures, will join us for some advice for American newsrooms, which they could really use right now.
Yes.
From both himself and from a bunch of other media critics and journalists and historians, on how the American media can and must correct course right now as we head into what Dan describes as, quote, another potentially cataclysmic election in 2024, arguably the most perilous in American history. That's all we'll be talking about. Anyway, first, voters...
Nothing special.
No, just nothing. Anyway, voters... some democracy news right off the bat here. Voters in New Hampshire and Pennsylvania headed to the polls for special elections on Tuesday as Democrats continued the pattern of winning in such elections that we have seen now time and again since the overturning of Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court last year and over and over and over again this year. Democratic candidates easily won special state legislative elections in both Pennsylvania and New Hampshire on Tuesday night, continuing the party's streak of strong performances in special contests, which is seen as a good omen for 2024 and giving Democrats a better chance of holding two critical swing state legislative chambers into next year. In New Hampshire, whose 500-member state house, yes, you heard that right, 500 members, that is the largest in the nation, In New Hampshire, Democrat Hal Rafter reportedly won a previously Republican-held seat northeast of Manchester, narrowing the Republican edge in the state house there to just one seat out of 500. 198 Republicans to 197 Democrats, with Democrats heavily favored for another special election scheduled for November, meaning the party could soon split control of the chamber and break the GOP trifecta controlling state government in the otherwise narrowly divided state. In Pennsylvania, meanwhile, former congressional aide Lindsey Powell won in a safe blue seat in Pittsburgh, meaning the party will maintain its narrow one-seat edge over Republicans, 102 to 101 in the state's House of Representatives. Republicans control the state Senate in the Keystone State, however, while the governor is Democrat Josh Shapiro. He won just last year in the 2022 midterms. Both races in Pennsylvania and New Hampshire continue not only a trend of Democrats winning in special elections since the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision overturned Roe v. Wade last year, but a trend of Democrats overperforming both President Joe Biden's 2020 results and the results of the 2022 midterms in special elections so far this year. The trend that began after Dobbs has only accelerated since the midterms last November, when Democrats far outperformed expectations for what would usually be a huge year for out-of-power Republicans during a midterm in which a Democrat is in the White House. For instance, former President Donald Trump narrowly won the New Hampshire district in 2020. The Democrats won on Tuesday night, with the Democrat Rafter beating the GOP nominee Jim Gusovsky by a remarkable 12-point margin, 56 to 44.
Mm.
Again, that was a district that Donald Trump won just over 2 years ago. And in Pennsylvania, well, Biden won the district, the safe district, which voted on Tuesday. Biden won that by 22 percentage points, so you can see why it's seen as a safe district. Well, that was already a blowout, but Powell on Tuesday defeated the Republican Aaron Ottenreith by 30 percentage points. So you see the improvement here. In these districts, legislative camp, the Heather Williams of the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee said these victories are shifting the balance of power in key states and putting Democrats in a stronger position to move this country forward. That after Democrats picked up an historic 4 new legislative majorities in last year's midterms. According to 538, Democrats have improved upon their partisan support in districts by a whopping 11 percentage points over the course of 30 state legislative special elections this year alone. The districts where Democrats have overperformed include both so-called blue and red districts alike. For example, from a majority black seat in Louisiana to Republican-leaning seats in rural Maine and Wisconsin. And despite somewhat misleading national polls for the 2024 presidential race, more than a year out, showing an essentially even race between President Biden and the criminally charged GOP frontrunner Donald Trump, even though we do not run national elections in this country, but state-by-state elections, the news could be still better in the critical swing state of Pennsylvania next year for Democrats. It will certainly be better for voters, for all voters, and yes, for democracy overall in the Keystone State. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro on Tuesday announced that the state will now automatically register eligible Pennsylvanians to vote when they obtain or renew identification cards and driver's licenses. The Democratic governor said in a news release detailing the plan, quote, "I'm committed to ensuring free and fair elections that allow every eligible voter to make their voice heard. Automatic voter registration, he said, is a common sense step to ensure election security and save Pennsylvania's time and tax dollars. 23 mostly Democratic-run states plus Washington, D.C. have now enacted some form of automatic voter registration, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. Well, starting this week, residents who go to the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation driver and photo license centers to get new or renewed licenses and ID cards, they will automatically be taken through the voter registration application process unless they opt out of doing so. Why anybody would want to do that? By the way, just because you're registered to vote doesn't mean you have to vote. You could be registered to vote and then just not go vote. So why would you want to opt out of doing so?
Yeah,
you got an idea?
That makes no sense whatsoever. But the good thing about doing it, say, at the DMV, is that there is an official there who is checking your identification to make sure
you
are eligible to vote.
There you go. Now, the governor's office has said that previously eligible voters had to take additional steps in order to opt into the voter registration process. And why is that? Well, because voter registration has, for decades in this country, been made as difficult as possible, longer than decades. It's been made as difficult as possible by those who oppose democracy and government of, by, and for the people. Plain and simple. That is it. That's the only reason why it's so difficult in so many states around the country to register. It's why we have a registration system at all, frankly. And with all of the various nightmares in our country and in our electoral system in recent years, automatic registration, as we've seen in many states now, is one of the very real upsides that easily allow more participation in the small d democratic process, no matter which side of it you consider yourself on. But of course, that's why so many neo-fascists and authoritarian Republicans tend to oppose automatic voter registration. But not all of them. Quote, the voter is already in a state government facility with their identification documents, documentation in hand, and they will have their picture taken and sign their name electronically. That, according to Pennsylvania's Secretary of the Commonwealth, Al Schmidt, a Republican who was nominated to the job by the Democratic governor, Josh Shapiro. Having all of that happen at the same time, said the Republican Schmidt, means the verification process is extremely secure and makes the registration process more efficient. Something else you would think that Republicans would be in favor of. You know, it's conservative, efficient, saves time and money for everyone. Pennsylvania House Republicans, however, bristled at the Democratic governor's actions, saying this should have been done via the legislature instead, which, of course, by the way, has not done so for years, when they certainly could have. Republicans controlled both houses for a long time. They didn't do it. Quote, this unilateral action on the eve of what is likely to be a hotly contested and close election will cause many Pennsylvania voters to continue to question the security and the results of our system, promised House Republican leader Brian Cutler, again, who could have applauded the move to a more small d democratic system and access to the polls to residents, to all residents in his state, including Republicans. Instead, he chose to use this pro-democracy effort to, yes, undermine confidence in democracy. According to Shapiro's office, as of December 22, 8.7 million Pennsylvanians were registered to vote, but more than 10.3 million were eligible to register, but had not. That is 1.6 million eligible voters in Pennsylvania who are not even signed up to do so. In a state where Republicans still control the Senate, but the House is controlled by Democrats by one single seat. Democrats won a whole lot of elections in 2022, notes Washington Post Greg Sargent, in no small part on their vow to strengthen and defend democracy. But if they hope to turn the issue into a sustained political winner, they have to deliver on that promise by showing voters what a pro-democracy governing agenda actually looks like. Sargent argues that Governor Shapiro's move is exactly that. Shapiro told Sargent, quote, "I see voter participation as key to strengthening democracy," noting that he's committed to ensuring free and fair elections and making sure every eligible voter can make their voice heard. The change, notes Sargent, could be dramatic, and all of this has the makings of an important experiment, he writes. Perhaps no Democrat campaigned as aggressively in defense of democracy in last year's midterms as Shapiro did. As the state attorney general back in 2020, he fought Donald Trump's efforts to reverse his loss. That would be to try to steal the state. And in 2022, the year that Shapiro was elected, he vowed to use the governorship to prevent a future stolen election, parlaying all of that into a landslide victory over the far-right ultra-MAGA opponent Doug Mastriano, who I hear is running for the U.S. Senate in Pennsylvania this year. I'm all for him. In Pennsylvania, the state GOP continues to elevate election deniers to positions of local importance, writes Sargent, in effect feeding doubts about the state's voting system itself. If automatic registration can make the voter rolls more accurate and make the system of enrollment and registration more efficient and user-friendly, that could make voters less susceptible to that sort of MAGA demagoguery, writes Sargent. This is why those who win elections by vowing to protect democracy should deliver on a broader pro-democracy program, he says. In Minnesota, Democrats who gained ground at the state level passed such a package earlier this year. Such policies, which include expanded early voting, same-day registration, no-excuse absentee voting, are all designed to make election systems more functional and inclusive, inclusive for all parties. Republicans, by contrast, at the state level, Sargent notes, have been gerrymandering, restricting ballot access, manipulating the rules of political competition for decades. But Trump has exacerbated those tendencies. Right now, Republicans in numerous states are responding to recent election losses by supercharging anti-democratic, anti-majoritarian tactics, even though evidence is mounting that people are growing accustomed to voting in defense of democracy. Right, Sargent, offering a concrete pro-democracy agenda is a good way for Democrats to keep reinforcing that positive dynamic and keep putting MAGA on the defensive, which is hard to disagree with. Of course, merely saying so, merely supporting automatic voter registration for all potential voters of any party or no party at all, that might be one of the things that journalists might be accused of being partisan for merely being in support of, merely being in support of broader democracy. Mind you, the process does not make it any more easy or difficult for any particular party to register voters. It makes it easier for all voters. But we have arrived at a point in this country where being pro-democracy is somehow tied to being pro-democratic party, which should, in fact, tell you quite a lot about where the Republican Party has now ended up in this country. That's why I have characterized the upcoming elections next year as not so much a contest between Democrats and Republicans, but between democracy and autocracy. But pointing out those facts, they're just facts. They're indisputable facts. Pointing that out is still seen as partisan unfortunately, in too many newsrooms around the country, leading journalists to pull punches on reporting basic facts and basic truths, which, by the way, that ends up helping Republicans. Which, of course, is the whole point of falsely describing the media as liberal and facts as somehow pro-capital D Democratic. Unless and until the U.S. media find a way to impart these cold, hard facts to the American people and get over their long, dumb contagion of being called partisan when they are simply reporting facts, and they stop trying to level a decidedly unlevel playing field by both sidesing their coverage, which is ultimately a favor to an increasingly authoritarian Republican Party, this nation remains at grave risk and the world along with it. And that is where the media needs some help. And fast. We've got some. Longtime journalist and press critic Dan Frumkin is here with some of that, and not a moment too soon. That's next on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently, without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
I need some good news, baby. Feels like the world's gone crazy. Give me some good news, baby. Give it to me. Give it to me.
Yes. Please do. We could use some good news, and I don't mean just good news like good news. I mean good news like good news. As opposed to bad journalism. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Yesterday on the program, I briefly cited some new polling out from Harvard University and the Harris Poll, which found that that voters are essentially evenly divided when it comes to the GOP's ridiculous and evidence-free impeachment inquiry of President Joe Biden. Given the extraordinary lack of evidence tying Joe Biden to any high crime or misdemeanor related to any of his son Hunter Biden's questionable business dealings, despite a 5-year investigation by a Trump-appointed DOJ prosecutor, along with an IRS investigation over those same years, and some 9 months of congressional probes in 3 different GOP-led U.S. House committees to date, finding, and to be clear, finding zero evidence of any wrongdoing by the President of the United States. Given all of that, it is remarkable that any survey of the American people would find voters are divided on whether Joe Biden's conduct was somehow worthy of an impeachment inquiry. Nonetheless, the new survey out this week finds voters just over 1 year out from the next presidential election are evenly split, 50-50, on whether the new impeachment inquiry announced unilaterally last week without a House vote or debate by Speaker Kevin McCarthy actually raises legitimate questions about Biden's conduct or is mostly politically motivated. The American people are 50-50 on that. Those numbers, which frankly should be alarming to both Democrats and media alike, after all, it is their job to inform the American people as to what is really going on in both their dysfunctional government and faltering democracy. But those numbers might not come as much of a surprise these days, given that a number of other polls in recent weeks, for example, find Joe Biden essentially tied with Donald Trump, the GOP frontrunner for the 2024 nomination, despite the fact that Trump is now facing 91 criminal felony charges in 4 different jurisdictions. No matter what you may think of Joe Biden's age or an economy which is doing very well, at least on paper, with record low unemployment, falling inflation numbers, if not in real world perceptions by many Americans who see food prices still high, gas prices surging again, and spiked interest rates on home mortgages. No matter what you may think, it's remarkable to think that the American people are pretty much, you know, havesy-havesy on whether they would prefer a president who competently helped us out of a worldwide pandemic, restored sanity to the White House, and has shepherded a plethora of progressive legislation through a bitterly divided Congress during his first term of office, or the guy who tried to steal a presidential election, overthrow the U.S. government by fostering an insurrection, stole thousands of highly classified national documents upon leaving the White House and refused to give them back, and who is now facing 91 criminal counts for all of the above. Well, I guess those both sound pretty good to Americans, I guess. What explains all of this? Longtime political media critic Dan Frumkin took a stab at some of these questions in trying to figure out where the media have gone wrong in recent years and where they can now go right on the eve of what he described last month as our coming, quote, chaos election. None of our newsroom leaders could possibly have imagined 10 years ago, writes Frumkin in his Press Watch newsletter, that fascist appeals to violence and racial hatred would be so common and effective, that the political discourse would be so awash in misinformation and disinformation, that homophobia and misogyny would make such a dramatic comeback, or that a con man who engineered a failed coup could be a front runner for the presidency, posing a dire threat to the country's future as a democracy. But even as the nation faces another potentially cataclysmic election in 2024, arguably the most perilous in American history, Frumkin writes, the mainstream news industry continues to engage in the same business as usual that got us here in the first place. Maybe it's time to change things up, Frumkin asks rhetorically. He writes that he decided to survey a few dozen experts, all of them critical readers of the news, many of them journalists, asking for their suggestions of what our top newsrooms should do differently this time around. Generally speaking, he notes, their answers are not radical. They are simply common sense. Well, no wonder they're so difficult for the corporate media to carry out at this point, I guess. Some call for changes that have been necessary for a long time and are now urgent, existentially so, he says. But some changes are specific to this moment when one of our two political parties has become so extremist and anti-democratic that so-called both sides reporting is no longer a safe harbor for political journalism. Indeed, it actively misinforms the public about the stakes of the coming election. Which is, of course, a point that we have been trying to underscore for years now on this program and, of course, at bradblog.com. So we more than welcome the help here on this from Dan Frumkin. Joining us now is Dan Frumkin, editor of Press Watch and a longtime champion of online accountability journalism. He headed up Washington Post's wildly popular and must-read at the time White House Watch for more than a decade, including during the George W. Bush years, and following his removal from the Post for, I think, telling too much truth too directly and too consistently and not doing enough both-sidesing it. Frumkin went on to write for Huffington Post, The Intercept, the Nieman Foundation's Watchdog Project, and now via the nonprofit PressWatchers.org newsletter with his motto, quote, I afflict comfortable journalists. Oh, Dan Frumkin, great to have you back on the broadcast, my friend.
Well, thank you. Hi, Brad. How are you?
Well, given everything that's going on, I'm okay, I guess.
Yeah, I've always said the Trump presidency was the death of small talk. How
yeah,
are you?
Really? Well, yeah.
God, where do I start?
Yeah. Right? Don't ask. Anyway, Dan, you spoke a lot to a lot of fantastic folks in this piece, and even asked readers to share the piece with folks who might be in leadership positions in American newsrooms. And I want to talk about some of the specific advice that journalists and historians and so forth shared in a bit. But I want to begin in broader terms, bouncing off some of the polling that I referenced in the intro. The Democratic Party in the White House is itself no doubt responsible for no small part of what I see as wildly off-base understanding of facts by the American people. And yet, I still come back to the media when I see those 50-50 poll numbers, because ultimately it feels like their failure. Ultimately, it seems like it's their job, our job, if you will, to inform the American people about what is true and what is false. And clearly, they are not succeeding, Dan. Am I right, or am I underestimating the responsibility of the political parties, in this case, Democrats, at getting their own message out and their own accomplishments out to the American people?
Well, I think a lot of the members of the Washington Press Corps would say that it is the Democratic Party's fault. But I agree with you. It's not the Democratic Party's job to correct misinformation. It's the Democratic Party's job to make its Democratic arguments and the Republican Party to make Republican arguments. And it's the press's job to come in and say, this is, in fact, correct. And in an environment now where there are so many untruths flying around, mm-hmm. saying this is just not the case. And instead, what you have is exactly what you talked about in the intro, this ridiculous cycle that I keep seeing, which is that the media basically underinforms people about what's going on. Mm-hmm. And then when the polls come out showing that they're underinformed, they write a big article about saying, hey, the people yes. are terribly underinformed.
Yes. Yeah, it's just like a self-reinforcing feedback cycle.
Right. And, I think that the origin story here really is key, because it goes back to the day that Trump won the 2016 election. And nobody in the news business expected that. I mean, the people forget that. Nobody expected that to happen. Mm-hmm. And so they weren't prepared, and they didn't really change. And that was a moment when they needed to change, and they didn't. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, it's been a moment for them that they need to change, and they won't. So they're still not changing. They're still, yes, they'll call Trump a liar. They'll say that he lied. But fundamentally, they're still adopting the right-wing frames. They're still not rebutting misinformation with the enthusiasm they should. They're still doing the horse race journalism, which allows them to be gamed by politicians, especially on the right. You would think that at some point they would realize that they're not doing it the right way anymore. Mm.
Well, you would think, but it has been years that folks like you and me and many others have been calling them out for that, even before the 2016 failure. And that's certainly what
True.
It is. But I got to say, Dan, because I question myself on this. I see day after day, the White House is trying to let the American people know what they're doing. I see Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and, executive secretaries and so forth out singing their own praises of their landmark policies. They're going to factory openings and so forth, discussing the $400 billion investment in climate change and bringing manufacturing back to the U.S. It seems like they are doing their job, but if the media are not covering it, or they're spending the bulk of their time talking about, Donald Trump defending himself against 91 felony counts, which I admit is newsworthy.
It's a big story.
who is actually to blame at that point? The Democrats or the media or Donald Trump?
Well, it's funny because just last week, Ian Sam, is one of the press folks at the White House, mm-hmm. Wrote a letter to the news media basically saying, guys, come on. Cover this like you should cover it, mm-hmm. which is basically that they have nothing. Mm-hmm. They've got nothing. It's a complete fishing expedition. It's a complete distraction from the business of the government. Come on. And of course, this fell on deaf ears because news executives do not like being lectured like by the kindergartners, which mm-hmm. is unfortunately what they are.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much more the White House could be doing right now. Given that the press has a blind eye towards Biden's successes mm-hmm. and is focused instead on whatever the Republicans are talking about, which is impeachment and Hunter Biden these days, and now this ridiculous imbroglio about the budget. They can't even get them agree amongst themselves on a budget plan mm-hmm. that would never fly with either the Senate or the White House. Mm-hmm. there's massive dysfunction on the right, and unfortunately the media feels like when it reports that, it's being biased, you know, it's being liberal. And if God forbid it should write anything nice about Biden, then it would definitely be accused of being liberal.
Yes, of course. I do notice you mentioned that the problem seems to be with news executives. You also focused in your piece, you know, let if you know any newsroom leaders know, your headline, a desperate appeal to newsroom leaders on the eve of a chaos election. I find that interesting. Are they the problem here rather than the journalists themselves, as you see it?
Well, yes. I mean, not rather than, but in addition to, or rather, they're the first cause. Mm-hmm. I mean, these journalists would not be doing what they're doing if it wasn't what their bosses wanted them to do. I mean, somebody asked me the other day, you know, is this the debacle of the interview that Kristen Welker did with Donald Trump? Mm-hmm. You know, is this her fault? And I was like, well, yes, but, you know, she was clearly sent in with instructions. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure she followed them, because that's what the stars do. I mean, the stars in our media firmament got there not necessarily out of talent, but because they did what their bosses told them to do. So, yeah, I don't think that any of these folks could unilaterally say, I'm going to start writing differently, or I'm going to start, you know, doing my job differently. I think that it's a question of the corporate cultures within their newsrooms.
And that interview with Kristen Welker was pre-taped. So, you know, her executive producer above her could have looked at that and said, you know, hey, great job, Kristen. Now let's intersperse your questions and his answers with actual facts. It wouldn't have been that hard. And, you know, again, I think that's ultimately the responsibility. I know if it was at Brad Blog, if a journalist, a reporter came to me with a story and I thought, well, it was good, but it needs this or that, it would ultimately be my responsibility to make sure that got added to the story, you know, before publishing it at my site. Let's,
and it was a tremendous missed opportunity, because precisely because it was taped, they had that ability, and them not choosing to do it is a very significant choice.
Let's jump into some of the specifics here that you go through, and it's a long piece with a lot of, you know, great feedback from a lot of really talented journalists and historians and so forth, some of whom we've had on the show over the years. But let's go to so I'll link to that so you can get the full story, but we'll go to some of these items starting right at the top. Pick the right frame, you advise. You cite Jennifer Mersica, who notes that historian who notes that there is a difference between a democracy frame and a horse race frame. I think this may be the easiest for our listeners to understand, because we discuss it all the time. But what is the difference between that democracy frame and that horse race frame? How does it affect the way that media consumers perceive a presidential election?
Well, because it's the difference between a popularity contest and a question of what kind of America do you want to live in? And, you know, the horse race frame is basically who's ahead, who's behind, you know, who has an ad out, what have you, who said something at what, you know, state fair. Mm-hmm. But a democracy frame would be looking at the stakes, at what this person would be like when they governed. And, you know, so there have been occasional stories here and there that do a fairly good job of pointing out what an incredibly radical presidency a second Trump presidency would be, mm-hmm. in terms of undercutting bureaucracy, the federal bureaucracy, and God knows what else. So that's the difference between a democracy frame and a horse race frame. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's not just that frame. It's like basically any story you feel almost like Matt Drudge is the assignment editor here. You know, the way that the story is framed. So, for instance, look at the impeachment hearing story. Mm-hmm. The story is framed as, here's what happened at today's impeachment hearing, instead of, what the hell are we doing having an impeachment hearing right. when there's absolutely not a shred of evidence to suggest that there's anything there. You know, the articles every day should be, this is, you know, in another attempt to distract from the, you know, from the business of government, Republicans staged a clown show, you know, to basically spout a lot of nonsense. Well, I mean, I wouldn't put it quite in those terms, but fundamentally, the meaning that's an accurate assessment of this impeachment hearing. Not you know, Merrick Garland was under fire yesterday.
But actually, it is accurate, and I would put it that way in covering it. I think that's just fine. But you know, we talked a little bit about this on the show yesterday. You know, part of me wants to just completely ignore it because it is such nonsense. It is so much of a clown show. But then I look back at, you know, 2016, Hillary Clinton, but her emails. I can go all the way back to John Kerry, 2004, the Swift boating, when you think these claims are so ridiculous, they don't merit coverage. And yet they are wildly effective, as I noted in that polling at the top of the segment here. Somehow this stuff works. The American people believe 50-50 that maybe Joe Biden did do something wrong. How do you respond to that nonsense without giving a platform to that same nonsense?
Well, I think, again, it's in the framing. If you say basically at the beginning that this is, you look at motive, you know, you don't just look at what they say. You say Republicans are doing this for this reason. I mean, the Hunter Biden story is a perfect example. Unlike Hillary's emails, where there was actually some investigative reporting that, drip, that continued to find stuff that was incriminating for her. We haven't found anything incriminating about Joe Biden. I mean, Hunter Biden obviously was a disaster, but so they shouldn't be, yes, they should be covering this stuff, but they should be covering it in the context of that this is an attempt to distract, that this is not the business of government right now. We have things to do, and we have crises to face. You know, and the solution would be for these newsrooms to not just follow the agenda of the Republicans, but to set their own agenda and to say, look, here are the problems facing this country. Let's see who's trying to solve them and what are they doing about it and who's blocking that. Mm-hmm. That's the antidote. There's no way to write about the impeachment hearing in a way that's really going to be, that's going to change people's views tremendously. But if you talk about, here are the problems we have, let's talk about climate change. Who's out there actually proposing changes that would help? Let's talk about let's talk about democracy. Who's talking about letting more people vote and being more representative, and who's not?
On the picking the right frame point, Marcika also makes a note that really cuts right to it. She says it matters if we call the situation at the border, southern border, a humanitarian crisis or an invasion or a relief effort. And that sort of puts it into stark contrast. It really does. Just those three, take your pick of those three phrases. It will make a difference in how news consumers perceive what it is you are reporting on. And of course, something you and I have talked about in the past, Dan, I've been hammering this. Everyone understands that stealing an election is unlawful, whereas, reversing an election, undermining it, questioning it, well, that might be legitimate. And yet that's what we see media still reporting as Donald Trump tried to undermine the results.
And Trump stealing the documents from the White House. Those documents were the property of the American public.
Yep.
That's what the Presidential Records Act says. It doesn't give him cover, you know, and he stole them.
Yeah. And it's the stolen documents case. It's not the Mar-a-Lago case, the Mar-a-Lago documents case, as we hear. That stuff does make a difference. You say, let's go on some of these other specifics here. Report on not the odds, but the stakes. Again, seems like a no-brainer to me, but apparently not to much of the media. NYU media professor Jay Rosen notes, what does that mean exactly for reporters who seem to spend almost 95% of their coverage, and I'm being generous there, I think, on polling? What are the difference between the odds and the stakes?
Well, again, this is a phrase that was coined by Jay Rosen, and I think it really does a lot of lifting. The idea, as he says, is that you look at not at the chance of winning, but at the consequences for a democracy. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, then you can actually, instead of just sort of looking at polls and reading tea leaves, mm-hmm. you can actually bring the depth of experience that reporters have about the topics that they're writing about. And so it's a much more interesting article at the end of the day than just who's up, who's down. And it's much more, it serves the readers so much better.
You talk about setting the agenda, that the media ought to set the agenda. Is it up to the media to discuss what they want to talk about, or is it up to to the candidates to let the media and the American people know what they are running on and hoping to accomplish in office?
Well, sure, a bit of both, absolutely. And then also the third element is, what do the people want? I mean, mm-hmm. there's a movement to try to determine what is the citizens' agenda. And I think one of the ways that news organizations should be setting the agenda is by going and talking to people, talking to regular Americans and saying, what's their agenda? What do they care about? And then championing that. But yes, I'm not talking about ignoring candidates, mm-hmm. but I'm saying, let's identify what our problems are, and then pick an issue, whether it's Social Security or healthcare or climate change or whatever, and say, okay, what are people's positions? What do we do about this? And have constructive discussions about that, rather than just talking about sound bites and who's polling better.
It's as you mentioned, asking what the American people might actually want to know. It reminds me, in the town hall formats over the past many years, and Donald Trump has sort of blown up our ability to do that in any helpful or cogent way. But over the years, during these town hall formats, during the debates and so forth, one of the things we always hear after the debates from the media is, boy, those American people sure had good questions for the candidates. And it's true, they do. And yet you think they might learn something from that and do somehow more of that, actually find out what it is the American people want to know, instead of that sort of self-reinforcing feedback cycle that we referenced earlier.
Yeah, no, it's a function of sort of the your average political reporter barely gets away from behind their desk anymore. It doesn't actually go talk to people.
You write about the importance of context. You cite Joanne Lipman, Gannett's former chief content officer. They publish USA Today and hundreds of other local newspapers. She notes that journalists cover every story through the lens of left versus right, which means news consumers are woefully ill-informed on basic topics. Bidenomics, she says, has been quite successful, for example, but most people wrongly believe the economy is in the toilet. Our understanding of policies is even worse. Again, won't media be perceived as taking sides if they were to characterize Biden's economic accomplishments as quite successful, as she describes it? And how does offering context change that equation, Dan?
Well, let's just say, for instance, that Bidenomics has been successful. Then wouldn't reporting that it was be accurate and not taking sides? I mean,
yes.
I know it's kind of a thought puzzle there.
That's
right?
Crazy, I mean, talk, Dan. Yeah.
Every time the job numbers and stuff came out, you would see news organizations saying, yeah, they look good, but, mm-hmm. But we're really headed for a recession. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a complete pessimism about anything that Biden does, mm-hmm. and it infects the coverage. And I understand reporters not wanting to be boosters, and they shouldn't be boosters, but they should be accurate, for the love of God. And they should put things in context. My favorite advice in that section was from Jim Fallows, who was one of the great giants of journalism, who says, read some goddamned U.S. history.
Yes. Yes. Let's talk about what not to do. One piece of advice, also from Joanne Lipman, is, quote, stop getting sucked into culture war soundbites that are simply meant to inflame and get coverage. Now, of course, I agree, but that so-called culture war, Dan, has now become legislation, law in many places. Abortion has been banned. Books are being removed from libraries. Teachers are being censored by the government and threatened with firing or worse for simply talking about sexuality, race, gender, etc. How do you correctly cover those culture war issues without sharing one entire side of the issue as purposely inflammatory as it may be?
Well, I think that You know, one thing I was thinking about this yesterday. One thing that you don't get much is coverage of the positive sides of pluralism. I mean, I think that that as the country, you know, gets more and more steeped in a certain state, certainly in homophobia and misogyny and virulently, violently anti-trans behavior and so on. Mm-hmm. We need to actually, as the media, remind people of what America is, which is ideally a pluralistic country where differences are appreciated, not demonized. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a whole message that's missing from this. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, yes, of course we have to cover it, but you sort of do the equivalent of the truth sandwich. The truth sandwich is when you cover a lie, you say, here's what's true, here's what they said that was a lie, and here's again what's true. What you do is you say, you know, people have a right to exist, look at what they're doing in Florida, and then go back to the joys of pluralism. I mean, it's about the framing. If you just let these people, you start with, here's what they did, here's why they did it, here's more why they did it, and then here's a Democrat saying it's not a good idea. Mm-hmm. That's not very good coverage at all. That's what we see time and time again.
You and I want to get to one other story that you wrote last week. So last question for now on this issue of advice to newsroom leaders. You have a section here called "Defend Yourself," which I kind of want to read as, for God's sakes, man, defend yourself. Journalism itself, you note, is under attack. How should journalists themselves be pushing back on that attack? But doesn't that place them at the place them themselves at the center of the story? And isn't that what, as Jay Rosen would say, you know, the view from nowhere journalists, they're not supposed to be inserting themselves. How are they supposed to push back on that attack?
Well, you know, you don't just broadcast the attack. You put it in context. You say, here is why, you know, here is the role that journalism plays. Here's what we do as journalists, and here is why it's engendering this incredible hostility. I think that's a hell of a good story. Mm. So you tell it. I mean, you don't contribute to basically the undermining of your own legitimacy, as one of the people I talked to said. That's, you know, the fact is that this is the way authoritarian regimes start their march to authoritarianism, is they undermine independent media. That is almost always the very first step. Mm-hmm. So that's saying these people are attacking us, and not like boo-hoo, but this is what authoritarians do.
Dan, you also, I want to hit this before I let you go, wrote a piece with some advice for CNN, who I think needs a lot of advice these days, Dan. It's headline, CNN should become the anti-Fox pro-truth network. You write, in a media environment awash in malignant misinformation, there is an obvious open path a revived CNN could follow under new CEO Mark Thompson. It is to rebut the lies as enthusiastically and entertainingly as Fox and others spread them. So I call on CNN to relaunch itself as the anti-Fox. But Dan, as I am told, though I disagree, isn't MSNBC already the anti-Fox?
I don't think so. I think that it doesn't actively rebut the misinformation the way that it does. It sort of ignores it too much. Mm. And I think to some extent, it actually is a little bit more of sort of left-wing propaganda as a contrast to Fox and right-wing propaganda. I don't think it's anywhere. It doesn't pervert information. Mm-hmm. I mean, the parallels are very, I don't want to stress that too much because MSNBC is not the Fox of the left.
Right. It helps Fox to describe MSNBC as the Fox of the left.
Yeah, I mean, Fox does not adhere to basic journalistic values. Mm-hmm. MSNBC does. But I don't know that it has adopted this notion of, we're going to explain and show what Fox is lying about. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't think that for the largest part, they have much fun doing it. This is a hell of a story.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got people who are just lying their asses off on a daily basis. And you know, actually, in some ways, it reminds me of Jon Stewart's The Daily Show. Mm-hmm. That was popular for a reason, mm-hmm. because he joyfully called out the lies. And I think you can do that as a news show, becoming, you know, just you can do it entertainingly.
Yeah, no, you can. And as you describe it in your piece, the CNN I have in mind would identify what the public misunderstands the most, then throw everything they've got at helping the public understand it better. This CNN would actively invite viewers who aren't news junkies and who may be low information voters to come in and get better informed. Well, there's an idea. This CNN wouldn't be partisan, but it would, but it also wouldn't be afraid to be perceived as partisan. I think that's really important. You write, it's sadly true that modern Republican Party has become so deceitful and divisive that taking a pro-truth, pro-pluralism stand is inevitably appears partisan to some. And then you add, did I mention this CNN would be fun? Anchors and reporters could revel in calling out the preposterous fabrications of Fox and other right-wing news sources. They could also mock the rest of the elite media for both-sidesing issues that are ultimately asymmetrical, and for being afraid to say what they know to be true. Boy, I don't know if I like that idea, Dan. It sounds like CNN would be stomping on the broadcast ground here if they did that.
I don't know. I think a little competition would be healthy.
It probably would. All right. Well, that is your slogan, after all, afflicting comfortable journalists. So thanks, Dan. Dan Frumkin, you can find his, and you should read this piece. It's detailed with some great advice from some great historians and journalists. Headlined A Desperate Appeal to Newsroom Leaders on the Eve of a Chaos Election. And of course, I'll also link to his article about CNN as well. You can find all of that at presswatchers.org. And I think, Dan, you're no longer on Twitter, but you're over there on Mastodon. Is that right?
No, I'm still on Twitter. I'm embarrassed, but it's still the best place for media criticism. To be heard and to speak about media problems. It's terrible. I hate it.
It is terrible. Shame on you, Dan. You can find him over at Twitter at Simply Frumkin. Dan, always great speaking with you, my friend. Look forward to doing it again soon.
Okay, take care, brother.
Thanks, brother. All right, we've got to get out. But yes. Desi Doyen, I'll tell you, one of the downsides of this sort of a criticism of the media is that it also allows them to say, well, the Republicans say we're doing a terrible job. The progressives and Democrats are critical as well. I guess we must be doing something right.
And of course, that is nonsense. That's not how facts work.
I can't believe you're going to start holding the journalists to reporting facts and worrying about that sort of thing. Anyway, we've got to get out. We will continue those worries in the days ahead, I suspect. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other we have ever done, you can download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you kind enough, thoughtful enough, generous enough to stop by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves and keep telling the truth. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and yes, site formerly known as Twitter. You will find me at The Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.